Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Gideon Long, and on this edition, we go to Kenya, where young people are moving to the big cities to look for work. What does that mean for those left behind?
That physical interaction that I talk to my parents and the children are seeing as communicating and interacting, we've lost that one.
We look at the economy of the Maldives and Islamic finance. And it's football transfer deadline day across much of Europe. Millions of dollars are changing hands.
Everybody is looking for the optimum for themselves. You know, the buying club wants to pay as less as possible and the selling club wants to receive as much as possible.
That's all to come, but we're starting today in Brazil because Elon Musk's X, the social media platform that we used to know as Twitter, has said it's expecting to be closed down there sometime in the next few hours. A Brazilian judge ordered X to appoint a legal representative in Brazil by Thursday. X failed to do so. I spoke to Andy Rosati, Bloomberg correspondent in Sao Paulo. He told us where we're at.
The last we heard was a court order that was ironically posted to the social network by the Supreme Court saying that if they do not comply and appoint a legal representative to the country, they are at risk of being shut down here. It is important to note that Elon Musk announced early this month that he was pulling staff from Brazil in kind of a protest to what he says unobtainable demands from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is demanding that they take down certain accounts or profiles that have been linked to kind of right-wing groups accused of promoting hate speech and kind of conspiracy theories. And Elon Musk, as we all know, is a self-avowed free speech absolutist. So he is taking or drawing a line in the sand, if you will.
And this has really only come to our attention just in the last day or so because things seem to have come to a head and X has said that it's expecting to be banned in Brazil. But this investigation has actually been going on for some time, right?
It's been going on for years. And the investigation is commonly known here as the fake news inquiry. It is really stemming from some attacks on the Supreme Court and other democratic Brazilian institutions that were started happening during the Bolsonaro years, Bolsonaro being the former right-wing president here. Various Supreme Court justices started receiving hate mail and actually very violent threats against them and their family. And there was a couple instances early on in the Bolsonaro years that the Supreme Court, some protests got pretty ugly. Now, over the years, this has really fanned out. The investigation, which is being headed by the Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, is looking into what he calls digital militias. These are groups believed to be actual people that are organizing online attacks, vitriol, and potential defamation against opponents of the former right-wing president or other people that have spoken out, mainly against right-wing politicians or Bolsonaro's movement.
And has the Brazilian president, Lula, said anything about this case?
Lula has essentially said that Musk would need to abide by Brazilian law here. And this is coming from the Supreme Court. It's very important to note that Elon Musk vocally backed former President Jair Bolsonaro. He had worked to get his satellite internet service Starlink in Brazil. And it's no secret that Elon Musk has supported many of these conservative political movements. Another example of this is Donald Trump. And Lula has spoken for the need for the very wealthy to pay their fair share in taxes and kind of made these kind of veiled jabs of people owning spaceships, which appeared to be a kind of a veiled attack or jab at Musk. So there's been some tensions between the two, to say the least.
And you mentioned Starlink there, another Elon Musk company, and the court's also taken some action against Starlink, right?
Correct. As Elon Musk has kind of refused to obey these court orders, the Supreme Court started slapping fines against his company X. It's not clear if these fines have been paid, especially since Elon Musk has shut down the office here in Brazil. It started coming out of local media that the Supreme Court has blocked accounts linked to Starlink to kind of look to pay for some of these fines that it's accumulated.
And can you give us an idea of how big X is in Brazil?
Social media is very popular here in Brazil, and X is one of the favorite apps to use here. Independent studies have shown that there may be around 20 million active X users here in Brazil. It's very important for many politicians and candidates when they're making announcements here. Oftentimes, it'll come out on X first.
Andy Rosati in Sao Paulo there. Now, the Maldives are a beautiful cluster of island in the Indian Ocean, known as a tourist paradise. But their economy isn't looking too good right now. The Maldives' foreign exchange reserves fell nearly 20% between May and July, and that's prompted ratings agency Fitch to downgrade the country's credit rating for the second time in 2 months. Much of the country's debt is in the form of something called a sukuk, an Islamic financial certificate similar to a bond that complies with Islamic Sharia law. No country has, until now, ever defaulted on a sukuk, and there are concerns the Maldives might be the first. To find out more, I spoke to Abdelkader Thomas, an independent consultant on Islamic finance.
The way to look at the Maldives sukuk is that they've been structured to be like a general obligation bond. So they followed basic Islamic rules. They found an asset backing without recourse to support 52% of the issuance. So the asset backing is without recourse, which means it's unsecured. So there is a veneer of a ijara or leasing transaction to support part of the deal, and rental from underlying government assets supports that. But those assets don't fall into the sukuk trust, which means that the investors can't reach through the trust and seize those assets to satisfy the obligations of the government of the Maldives.
So can you explain for us what Islamic debt consists of, Sharia-compliant debt, and what sukuk is?
So Sharia-compliant debt, instead of being structured as a loan or a bond, is usually structured as either a lease obligation or a sale obligation. So something has been sold to somebody, and they sell it onwards to get cash. But the initial sale creates the debt that they owe to somebody else. And so you see that the Islamic banks, they support their customers through leasing assets to them, selling them goods on installment credit, or providing them with cash through a relatively complicated transaction called commodity murabaha.
How does this compare with conventional debt? Does sukuk loans have different interest rates? How is it different?
So the pricing on these transactions is frequently peer to the conventional market. So you would probably have found that if Maldives had wished to issue a conventional bond, that they would have gotten a similar pricing offer from conventional underwriters. So the markets tend to move in tandem. This is mainly because the sukuk market is very small. And so the pricing, if it deviates too much, either attracts too many investors or not enough. So it tends to track tightly.
And how common is sukuk outside the Maldives in other countries in the Islamic world?
So the two main centers for sukuk today in terms of volume are Malaysia and Saudi Arabia. And both countries are producing $30 to $40 billion of transactions a year for government-linked companies and for the private sector. Malaysia has a bit more in the private sector than Saudi Arabia, but they're both very active and vibrant markets. And then UAE and London are key, frankly speaking, crucial market centers for the sukuk distribution and investment.
So it is a significant part of the global financial system.
It's about $150 billion US of issuance every year.
And am I right in saying that no sovereign sukuk has ever defaulted?
To my knowledge, no sovereign sukuk have defaulted, but I would give you a quick elliptical. Some of them have gotten into trouble and been bailed out by friends and family.
And is there any reason why they've never defaulted?
Well, I think on the one hand, many of the sovereign issuers have been investment grade, and so they've got their books in fairly good order. And even Malaysia skated through their crisis 1MBD without going into default or having any risk other than a ding to their reputation. So I think that's the first order, is that most are exactly the opposite of Maldives. They're not low investment grade or now sub-investment grade. They're actually AA and single A credits. And I think that holds going forward.
And is Sharia-compliant lending becoming more common than it was in the past?
So I think it's expanding across a number of markets that we would view in the West as frontier markets. And so there's now a vibrant domestic sukuk market, for instance, in Nigeria funding their roads. So if you recently went to Lagos and drove on a road that had no potholes, you would also see a sign that it was funded by a domestically issued sukuk to local banks and pension funds. And that is being replicated across Africa, Central Asia, and then other countries, including Pakistan, Indonesia, are very active in the markets. UK has issued a few times. So there's a pretty diverse, vibrant market in the emerging markets and frontier markets.
Abdelkader Thomas there. To Italy now, where the government's trying a new approach to boost revenues and tackle the backlash against mass tourism. Visitors could soon be paying a higher tourist tax that could mean them paying an extra €25 a night in the most expensive hotels. Hotel owners are worried it could drive tourists away, but not everyone agrees. Massimo Prediera owned a hotel for 20 years, but these days he runs an association that studies the environmental impact of tourism in the coastal town of Positano on the Amalfi Coast in southern Italy.
I don't think the raise of the taxes will change very much the attitude of the tourists. It will give more money to the local administration to provide better services, but I don't think it will influence in such places like Positano, where you have a very expensive accommodation. Raising the tourist tax from €5 even to €25 will not change the decision of anybody that wants to come to Positano. Positano is overwhelmed with overtourism. The sentiment is that we have got too many people. There are days where we have 35,000 visitors in a village that have 4,000 inhabitants. I don't think the tourist tax will help. This will not reduce the people who come to spend the night here. And the people who just come for a day visit, they don't pay a tourist tax.
And that sentiment is shared even by this tour guide in Rome, Felicity Hinton, even though she relies on tourist income.
The tourist tax will be used to gain some extra money for the city council, which is useful. It will not put off tourists. One pint of beer, really? No, I'm still going to go. I absolutely accept annoyed. But would it put you off going to your destination? It's not really about the tourist tax. It is about over-tourism. Bring on the tourists. I love the tourists. They pay me. But what about the people who live in these cities? There really is a balance to be made. And I'm not sure that charging €5 or €7 is going to fix that balance.
Tour guide Felicity Hinton there.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather. And there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened. Not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, all this week on World Business Report, we've been hearing about the impact that aging populations have on economics, both the opportunities they create, but also the challenges they face. We're ending the series in Africa. In many parts of the continent, young people are moving from rural to urban areas to seek a better life. As the BBC's Michael Kaloki in Kenya reports, in some instances, the elderly parents left behind are struggling to fend for themselves.
Okay. I'm making my way up a steep incline here in the Kilungu Hills. I'll just stop and catch my breath. The Kilungu Hills are located in Makueni County, about 120 kilometers or so southeast of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. I'm making my way over to Malunda Village, where I hope to meet Cosmas Dhunga. Cosmas is a widower who lives alone in the village. Right, so I've just arrived at Cosmas's homestead and I think I see him here. Hi, Cosmas.
Mzuri sana.
Eh, habari, I'm saying hello in Swahili, habari.
Sio mbaya, mzuri sana.
Okay, Cosmas is saying, not bad, I'm good. As I look around here, I see a few crops. Cosmas, is it you who grew these crops here?
It is me who grew these crops and I tend to them. I try and motivate myself to carry out the work that is needed here on the farm, but because I'm on my own, it is difficult. Because I would like to farm, but then again, I have to go and fetch water, I have to fetch firewood, and I end up having a very challenging time trying to do all that.
So what you grow here on your farm, is it for just yourself for consumption, or do you sell any of these crops here?
What I grow here, for example, the bananas and cassava, I do not sell any of them. It is just for my own consumption.
Three of Cosmas' six children married and moved to other parts of Makueni. His other children moved to the city in search of a better life. Cosmas feels that if his children had not moved to the city, life would have been much better for him financially.
If my children were here, we would have been able to help each other. But because they're not here, life is very challenging for me.
It is in many rural areas where elderly people are trying to live life on their own or with limited assistance from their children, who have left to seek out a better life for themselves in the cities. For those without sustained income or adequate financial support, they can often end up facing a myriad of challenges. This according to financial analyst Edward Kusewa.
If you look at the rural places, they don't have amenities, they don't have services. So what this means is that if you're in an environment or an ecosystem where there are no amenities and there's no availability of services, it means the costs are high. Now, for elderly people who need specialized care, for example, if someone has high blood pressure or diabetes and they need specialized care and they are living in rural Africa, it becomes extremely difficult for them.
A report released by the Kenya government last year noted that the elderly are the fastest growing segment of the country's population, with a report indicating that inadequate income is a challenge. Social cohesion can also be affected when the elderly are left on their own. Gladys Nyacheo is a sociologist in Nairobi.
Traditionally, we are socialized into a certain culture. And again, we are connected by social interaction. We are together, we talk. The social fabric is tight. But as we move away, and probably we don't even interact, then the disconnect is very big. You see, the phone is there, we are talking to them, yes. But that physical interaction that I talk to my parents and the children are seeing us communicating and interacting, we've lost that one.
As several urban areas in Kenya and on the continent continue to witness growth, attracting more young people, the future faced by the elderly in rural areas might likely become a significant concern.
Michael Kaloki reporting from Kenya there. Lebanon has been facing an energy crisis for some time, but it seems to be getting worse. Earlier this month, its only operational power plant shut down after the state-run electricity company ran out of fuel. That's led to major power outages. Christina Abi-Haider is a lawyer and independent energy consultant in the capital, Beirut.
Currently, like, we have maximum 2 hours of electricity supply by the state-owned company. Since last week, we had a total nationwide shutdown, total blackout, and this affected mainly like the vital sectors and vital institutions, such as like leaving the prison, the airport. Imagine like the airport without electricity, water pumps, sewage pumps. And this is a very like critical situation. People rely on informal and largely unregulated private diesel generators, which are like everywhere in the country, to supplement their supply. These private generators are very expensive. Lebanon is a bankrupted country since 2019, and expenditures on electricity played a major role in this bankruptcy. Lebanon, since 2021, is running on a single source of fuel, which is the Iraqi fuel. And this type of contract is a delayed paid contract, giving the Lebanese government a grace period to pay the expenditures of this contract. And we have now an accumulation of around $700 million by the end of this year on behalf of the Lebanese government to the Iraqi government. the government should react quickly in order to try to pay at least a little bit of this money, also to search for an alternative source of fuel. You should have diversification of sources of fuel. You cannot rely on one source.
Christina Abbey Hyder there. Let's take a look at the markets. I'm joined by Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Shanti, Eurozone inflation data out today, down to 2.2%. It's starting to feel really like inflation has been beaten, at least in Europe.
Yeah, and these numbers were in line with what was expected. So we haven't seen a big reaction from the market. We're expecting to see 0.5% to 0.75% of rate cuts in 2024. Broadly in line with what was expected and, you know, generally good news. If interest rates can be lower, that can support economic growth.
One slight exception to that, the French inflation was slightly higher than expected and services also high within that inflation data. This is partly due to the Olympics, right?
That's the suspicion. So Olympics probably led to higher hotel prices, higher services costs. Plus, it was, you know, over a period in the summer where there's potentially less workers available. So I don't think that's particularly cause for alarm. And the French numbers are still coming down.
One story that's been coming out of China just in the last couple of hours, China's central bank has begun trading in sovereign bonds in the secondary market. It's the first time it's done that in decades. What do you think is going on there?
So the interest rates on bonds in China have been falling really sharply over the past 6 months. And that's because people are expecting the economy might go into a period where they go into deflation or you know, actually prices falling, which is actually really economically harmful. So the central bank stepping in, they've tried to sell some bonds that are longer dated to try to push yields up a bit higher. I think you're going to need to see a lot more for investors to really change their view. China has been trying to intervene in markets and change sentiment, but no one's really buying it that much.
And GDP data out from India today, GDP moderated to 6.7%. Still pretty good, though. I mean, it's down from 8.2% earlier. Do you think, can we say that India is kind of replacing China as the motor of the global economy?
India is still a much smaller percentage of global GDP than China. So India is about 3.6% versus China at 17. But India is growing a lot faster. And India also, in terms of its equity markets, is becoming a much bigger portion of emerging market equity indices than China is.
Shanti, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, the end of August is approaching. And if you're a football fan, that means the end of the summer transfer window. It closes on Friday in many of Europe's big leagues. It's the last chance that teams have to buy new players until January. Traditionally, millions of dollars change hand just in the English Premier League alone as the deadline approaches. So how do you get a transfer over the line? One man who knows is Kees Vos, head of Sports Entertainment Group. He's an agent for the likes of Liverpool star Cody Gakpo and Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag. My colleague Matt Lyons sat down with him.
It must be quite busy for you at the moment, I imagine, with the summer transfer season going on.
It is. So I've been travelling all over Europe. This is actually first day in the office again for me.
A bit of background for you about Kees then. He set up SEG in 2000 with a childhood friend, Alex Kroos. It now boasts more than 600 clients, from players Rasmus Højlund, Cody Gakpo, to coaches Erik ten Hag, Pep Guardiola. In fact, it's been claimed he's the man controlling the ins and outs at Manchester United right now. He's got fingers in lots of pies, with SEG now having clients in cycling, esports and music. But what I wanted to know is how the football transfer window works from the inside.
It's all day by day in the window. Of course, you try to prepare as much as you can. But one hand, we represent talent. So then we try to do career planning with them. That goes from 17-year-old players to experienced pros. So that's an ongoing process which goes out throughout the year, I think. And then on the other side, we have clients which are clubs, you know. So that we are hired by clubs to help them renovate their squads.
Let's talk about getting a deal done then. What are the key things to making sure that parties agree?
You have to understand that if a transfer is made, there's three parties involved. There's a buying club, there's a selling club, and there's a player. And everybody is looking for the optimum for themselves. You know, the buying club wants to pay as less as possible, and the selling club wants to receive as much as possible. And the player wants to get the best deal or the best club out of it. And maybe if two clubs are in agreement, the player doesn't even want to go to that club. That's a possibility. If I go back 20 years, then you were managing a player or you were the agent of a player. The only point of contact was the player and then maybe his wife. And nowadays, it's way more than that. It's fathers, mothers, uncles, nephews, brothers, sisters. But then there's also, people they trust. It could be a financial advisor. It could be a next-door neighbor they knew from way before. It's a sexy business. It's appealing. So it appeals also to the people around a player.
So if that's how you get a deal done, what transfer is Kay's most proud he got over the line?
I've done many, many deals, but I think the one of Robin van Persie from Arsenal to Manchester United is one that really stands out.
Another new season, another new signing. Manchester United's capture of Robin van Persie from Arsenal, a timely reminder of why the Premier League remains so popular. Big money, big names and fleeting loyalty.
It was a deal between two clubs back then who didn't want to deal with each other. It was back then when Wenger was in Arsenal and Sir Alex Ferguson was running Manchester United. So it was not very likely that Robin would go to that club. To get that done was something I'm proud of. Yeah, I think it was a very good result.
And what then of a more recent high-profile deal that was secured?
All the talk going into the FA Cup final last month was that Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag was going to lose his job, whatever happened. Well, what happened was they won, and now 2.5 weeks on, he's staying in charge.
Manchester United have extended the contract of manager Erik ten Hag until June 2026.
Was he pleased when that was done?
If they're happy, I'm happy. If they don't want to continue with each other, then I'm also happy. It doesn't matter, you know. I'm not the one who makes a decision, you know. If a player moves or stays at a club, it doesn't matter for me. If he's happy to stay, then we're happy that he's happy. And in this particular case, there was a lot of speculation about it, but in the end, everybody decided that it was the right fit. So then I'm happy.
There was a lot of noise, a lot of social media noise about whether Erik might be replaced. Does that noise, does that speculation, is that bigger now than it ever has been? Does that make your job harder? Yeah. What does that mean in this case?
No, not only in this case. I think in general, the noise on social media is louder. And that has impact on the behavior of people because it does something to people and therefore impact on what clubs do and decide and what players do and decide. Everybody's a human being and whatever they read or their people around them read, that has impact. They're not robots, you know, they're human beings.
Football agent Case Vos there. And you can hear Matt's full report by listening today to today's episode of Business Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you do, spare a thought for the likes of Matt and myself, who support some of the smaller teams in English football, those that don't have the big bucks to spend on new players. That's it from this edition of World Business Report. I'm Gideon Long. Thanks very much for listening.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened. Not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.